Welcome to Architecture 2020, a podcast production of the Architecture Program at the University of Kansas. My name is Keith Diaz Moore, and I'm the chair of the Architecture Program. This program aims to stimulate a dialogue regarding the rapidly changing nature of professional architectural practice and the role of architectural education in that evolution. Our series begins with a conversation with Bob Birkebeil, a founder of BNIM Architects in Kansas City. He's also a fellow of the American Institute of Architects. Bob was instrumental in the creation of both the American Institute of Architects Committee on the Environment, as well as the United States Green Building Council. His firm, BNIM, has a reputation of trailblazing in the areas of both sustainable design and the use of building information modeling, two unquestionable forces in the evolution of today's architectural practice. On August 29th, Bob graciously welcomed Architecture 2020 into the bustling offices of BNIM for a conversation. Well, good morning, Bob, and thanks for sharing time with Architecture 2020.
I'm delighted to be here, Keith.
Great. Besides being the founder of BNIM Architects, you also were instrumental in the creation of the Committee of the Environment with the American Institute of Architects. I was wondering if you could share with us a bit of that history and how it came into being.
In the early 80s, I had an epiphany that was related to my recovery following the collapse of the Kansas City Hyatt Hotel. And I began looking at the issues of what are the real impacts of our designs on the people we intend to serve. Are we increasing their human health and productivity, the vitality of the community and the planet, or not? And in the late 80s, we took that question to AIA National. And we asked if they would establish a new committee and begin research on those issues. And they turned us down on the basis that it was too expensive and an environmental problem, and maybe the environmental group should be doing that research and not a professional organization. And so subsequently, the Kansas City chapter of AIA took a resolution to a national convention called Critical Planet Rescue, which asked the same question. And it was fortunately passed unanimously by the delegates, and that gave birth to this being on the agenda at AIA. Initially, it was assigned to a standing committee, Architecture and Energy. A few months later, the EPA committed separately to us $1 million to begin that research. And so with the funding, we went back to AIA then and said, shouldn't you reconsider? Shouldn't this reside at AIA and not in Kansas City with our firm? Mm-hmm. They agreed that it should. And so the committee then was officially embraced and established in 1990 at the annual convention in Houston. And from then until now, it's been a national standing committee.
And then there's a relationship between the Committee on the Environment and the United States Building Green Council?
About 4 years into the history of the committee, a conversation developed around with some of the participants at that time in the Committee on the Environment, and they were non-architects who were coming to our meetings, and they included David Gottfried, and who was a developer, Mike Italiano, who was an attorney, and they were asking us if we couldn't be raising more money from DuPont and a lot of the partners we had recruited to this research. And we all agreed that, yes, money could be raised, and they wanted to know why we weren't asking for more money from them. And I said, because we're publishing environmental information about the negative impacts of their products, and I don't want our research colored by those contributions. And so we all agreed that there should be a broader national discussion about this that would include financiers, contractors, developers, owners, educators, and not just professionals, architects and designers. So we hosted at AIA National the first conversation about creating such an organization, and a few months later, the people in that room decided it would become the U.S. Green Building Council, and I think, I don't remember the exact date, I think it was officially an organization around 1994, something like that.
And since the United States Green Building Council has gone on to develop the LEED standards, LEED certification, which has had so much impact in architecture over the last decade or so.
Right.
So since that time to today, we've been about 10, 11, 12 years, something like that. We're about that far away from the year 2020. I'm wondering if you could reflect a bit on what major changes you've seen over the last 10 or 12 years, and what changes do you think are only starting to begin?
Well, the primary changes, I think, in our practice over that period of time is that we, as a profession, have had a reduced voice or authority in the whole design, conceptualization, funding, the creation of ideas in our communities. And even in the design and construction arena, I think the role of the architect has been somewhat diminished in terms of representing the owner. And I think there have been a lot of reasons for that, one of which is an adversity for liability. And I think all the players in that arena have been advised by their attorneys and their insurance companies to protect themselves against areas of liability, which means there's a tendency to move away from important areas of decision making.
Sure.
And I think that's been unfortunate in terms of serving the public, because as everyone retreats from those critical decisions, it leaves more exposure to failure. And ultimately, I think the public loses in that arena. So I think that's been an unfortunate shift. Some of the good changes in that period of time, I think, are that communication and certainly computer technology has enhanced our ability to evaluate the performance of our designs. And that's a remarkable change. And I think if we manage well, that in the future that will dramatically change the performance of our individual structures and our communities if we continue to enlarge the patterns of performance that we're modeling. If we can get beyond energy to things like human health and productivity and changes in the vitality of a community by the location of the disparate parts and so on, and we can start modeling community vitality rather than individual building performance, I think it will dramatically change the vitality of our communities, the quality of our buildings, and the service offered by the design professions.
In terms of this evaluation of the performance of buildings, do you think the clients are setting that agenda, or the architects beginning to take the lead in trying to determine how one might begin to evaluate?
I think that a few architects and professionals started asking those questions and defining the critical issues and began asking a series of questions that gave rise to new opportunities. But at this point in the process, and this is more in the category of the changes that are just beginning and now need to be happening between now and 2020, mm-hmm. I think we've just scratched the surface. And what needs to happen is we need to define architecture as creating quality environments. And as a result, we need to look more at integrated design, at holistic approaches to design and construction. We need to look at the elegance of large systems like nature and learn from them as to inform our designs. So that would include using biophilia and architecture and neuroscience as a basis for decision making and creativity. And I think those are the breakthroughs that we are now beginning to define, but it's far from being general practice.
So do you think that this area of evaluation for productivity, health, sustainability, so forth, is that a potential ground for greater collaboration between the academy and architectural practice?
Absolutely. We know now that if we properly design schools, for example, using daylight and healthy materials, that the test scores improve 15 to 17% with the same faculty and same students. we know that in hospitals the length of the stay changes, and the trips to the nurse's stay from the nurses change, and the amount of drugs that are required change with good design. We know that factory workers' productivity increases, but it's all anecdotal. And so really understanding precisely what's happening in terms of the relationship between the built environment and human well-being and performance is still vague. And I think that's where the Academy has a huge role to engage in a direct partnership and dialogue with the profession. And it's rich, fertile ground from my point of view.
So you've laid out several agenda points here about where we might be going. So if you imagine yourself in an architectural office in the year 2020, what differences do you think will be in place in architecture at that point?
That's a great question. I think by 2020, we will have a larger pattern science built into our computer modeling tools.
And pattern science, can you describe that a little
bit more? Sure. It's looking at our environment as a part of a larger system. It's not looking at building as an isolated piece of sculpture or an isolated event on the landscape. It's looking at all of its connectivity in terms of the upstream environmental impact, in terms of the performance of the people who occupy it, in terms of it being a catalyst for healthy engagement and community building within its environment, all of those things. And I think that we have enlarged the conversation of what is good design to include sociologists and botanists and biologists and hydrologists and so on, to the point that the questions that are arising are very different. And so if architects and the Academy maintain this richer dialogue, I think we can start, first of all, relying on more brilliance in the conversation and in the design process. It can be a growing, what I would call, collaborative dialogue of discovery, that architects as generalists are playing a key leadership role, but there are contributions coming from a diverse group of professionals that heretofore have not been part of the architectural studio.
Well, then let's build off of that and think about how can we best, the universities best prepare students for this change in the profession that you described, this notion of pattern science, collaborative dialogue of discovery. How can we prepare students to engage in that successfully?
Well, first of all, it's important, I think, that students in general, and architecture students in particular, have some sense of the environment within which they are operating and have a real understanding of the direct link between the built environment and the vitality of the underlying natural capital which makes it possible and which makes our long-term existence on the planet successful. And I would submit that with few exceptions, we haven't enjoyed much of an understanding of that picture. Actually, at KU, I had the good fortune to have Bucky Fuller as a professor for a short period of time, and Bucky got that, and he exposed us to it, and he called it integrity. You know, for him, integrity meant that you would not just answer the question, but ask the underlying question. Why was that the question? And what is it that makes that possible, that question possible at all? And so, for example, one of the things I always remember, someone would point out the beautiful sunset, and he would say, no, the sun is not setting. The planet is rotating to eclipse our view of the sun. And so the same thing's true in our design work. We have to really understand that our community designs right now are threatening human life on the planet. And if you look at what we now know about the link between carbon and temperature, and if you look at the fact that the primary issue in carbon is how we design and build our communities, then we have a design problem. And by redefining that design problem and embracing that reality, it can be the largest restorative force on the planet. And so that's the opportunity, I think, for the profession and specifically for academy in this period of time between now and what I would call the year of perfect vision, 2020. Mm-hmm. By then, we will know that we have made the course change to be successful or not. But now's the time we have to make the course change.
To try and address that challenge, what do you think would be the characteristics of a studio that would best exemplify the nature of practice that you think will exist in 2020?
That's a great question, and I think we've been trying to address that here in the firm. But it starts with creating an environment within which discovery is the most important experience. It's immersing people in an environment of discovery. And so for me, that means it's more than a capable architect teaching architectural students to design. It must necessarily expose them to much broader issues. And so it would be very useful to have a biologist, an artist, an educator, a hydrologist, all in the conversation or the dialogue about defining the problem. So if the project is, pick a project, if it's an elementary school, having all of those voices engage the students and the faculty in defining the problem. What are we hoping to achieve? And then having them at least available on call for the students who can engage in that richer dialogue. And as a direct result, I think architects who tend to be creative and generalist can integrate those disparate concepts and create a more appropriate, what I would call regenerative solution, mm-hmm. so that it moves beyond just meeting requirements for a particular space need in an attractive environment. It moves to the point of assuring that every design decision increases the potential to add vitality to the social, economic, and environmental system simultaneously. Never finding ourselves caught in the limited thinking of, well, we might have to have a little trade-off here. The environment might have to take a little hit if our client really wants a good economic return, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Assuming that if you are going to do something positive relative to the environment, that you're going to have to spend a lot more money. Both of those are kind of obsolete ideas if we look at integrated thinking and large pattern science. And if we look at nature as model.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as though you're advocating a broad liberal arts base as well as interdisciplinary experiences.
Yes, absolutely.
In architectural education.
Absolutely.
How early do you think that should start in the process?
It should start when a child is growing up at home. Would be ideal.
Sure.
And certainly one would hope that even in their early formal education they would be exposed to the notion that we are all part of a large system, and understanding that relationship and exploring the beauty of it, the vitality of it, the richness of it. But if all of that has failed, then it's certainly important when they arrive at the university in the early courses to acknowledge and expose them to the fact that architecture is an important role in the creation of our communities, but that it's only has integrity if we recognize that we are having a huge impact on the natural capital that supports us, and that to be a professional with integrity, we have to be sure that our designs increase the vitality of that natural capital, of those natural systems that support our well-being.
Well, great. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time and sharing your thoughts with Architecture 2020.
Thanks, Keith.
Thanks, Bob.